You're listening to Up North News with Pat Kreitlow.
Welcome back to the third hour of Up North News for Labor Day Friday, September 2nd. And happy anniversary to my sweetheart. Not the wedding one, but the one of when you met. We met on Labor Day Saturday at, as all good marriages do, that started at UW-Eau Claire, in a bar on Water Street. So we will probably, again, make our pilgrimage after 39 years to what was then known as the Brat Cabin. I think it's just known as the Brat. I don't think there's any signage there now. One of the, not one of the classier joints in town, but it's where we met. I was brought by a buddy of mine. She was brought by a friend of hers. The friends were dating at the time. And so we introduced ourselves at, we're talking, the two of them got into a spat and broke up right in front of us and headed out. So there's me and Sherry going, so what was your name again? Hi. And can we go someplace else? And so we went to a different bar down the street and talked for hours. And that was when I thought I had made a great impression on her. And I did not know at the time that she was going to turn out to be the girl of my dreams and that we'd be married for, you know, 36 years now and know each other for 39. But it turns out it was all based on a lie. I thought she was really enjoying the conversation. Like I said, we talked for hours and she claimed she did, but she also let it be known at some point that she said that night she was still massively hungover from the night before. And so she was just doing a lot of smiling and nodding and saying, that's cool, which is not how I remember it at all. We actually did have some great conversations, but she likes to poke a little fun at herself about, you know, why she was so attentive that night. If that's what it took for me to get a girl like that, then thank you to whoever was out with her the night before, because the night we met, you know, changed my life. And I'm very happy about that. Do you have a similar meeting at a bar in Madison story for your betrothed?
No, we met at, we worked at the dining hall together here at UW. So we actually worked together, and we worked together for a year without really knowing each other, and then met sophomore year. And that's when we started dating. So not at a bar. I may have been hungover. I don't recall.
Oh, that was probably a evergreen status, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of just how it was. We worked together at the dining hall, and we've been together ever since.
So you'll like this again in the frame of Ron Burgundy. The thing that she first noticed about me was she said, "Hey, didn't I just see you on TV?" And in fact, she had, because I was on the campus TV station, host of the Saturday night movie night thing. So you just point the camera in the control room, you talk about the movie, you roll the movie. After the movie, I said something along the lines of, "Time for us to sign off, see you on Water Street." And so there we were, meeting each other on Water Street. So the next day, on a Sunday of Labor Day weekend, you know, the TV station wasn't programming. A lot of people were away for the weekend. I asked if she wanted to see the TV station, and she did. And then I showed her, and again, you'll love this, I showed her the latest technology of the time, something called VHS cassettes, and that we had about 100 movies, you know, on VHS. We looked like a tiny Blockbuster. And I said, you know, what would you like to watch? You can watch any movie that you like. And so she picked out a movie, and we set up a TV and watched a movie. So that was how I impressed my new date, and eventually.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Eventually, conned her into marrying me, and so that was all 39 years ago this weekend. Saturday Night Live is going to look a lot different next season. They had already lost Kate McKinnon, Adi Bryant, Pete Davidson, Kyle Mooney. And now it's been announced that Melissa Villaseñor and Alex Moffat are leaving the cast as well, or were asked to leave. I'm not sure which one it is, but I was really kind of liking Melissa Villaseñor. And of course, Kate McKinnon, in my mind, is, you know, on the Mount Rushmore of Saturday Night Live cast members. So things are going to look a little different with the one exception, the Keenan Thompson. I mean, don't we think Keenan Thompson's going to be there now? He's going to play the old man because he's going to become the old man. I mean, they've never had an elderly cast member and they're well on their way.
It's funny because Keenan Thompson, I grew up watching on that.
Keenan and Kel.
Keenan and Kel and all that. All that was the kind of SNL version of what Nickelodeon did.
Right.
And so it's weird for me almost because he's just kind of been a mainstay for some of that sketch comedy that I've been watching my entire life. So it's a nice thing.
And he still is. And I mean, that's
really good at it.
I know. Well, see, that's just that. It's not like, you know, I have been saying he's good, so he should stay there for that long. The opposite of that for me, it's not comedy, but it's news, is Wolf Blitzer. For 30 years, I've been like, how is this guy still on TV? How does he still, year after year, get to survive all the changes? Because I happen to think he's completely unwatchable. But clearly enough other people have watched him and like him that he is the Keenan Thompson of cable news. And that is the only time, folks, you are ever going to hear Keenan Thompson and Wolf Blitzer compared to each other in the same sentence. Let's take a break. We'll have more after this on a Friday morning. You're up north. In our first hour this morning, we talked about how we weren't seeking to become, you know, so centered on Ron Johnson in the U.S. Senate race. It's just that he continually is doing things or things are being reported that we talk about. In our second hour, we talked to one of our colleagues in Pennsylvania who said more or less the same thing about the race involving Dr. Oz and John Fetterman. That, again, it's Oz who is saying or doing or representing things that need to be called out. Well, there'll be another one about Ron Johnson here in just a couple of minutes. Again, things that just come up, and there's no reason to sit and parcel them out. As they come up, we will share them. But before I get there, I want to share a post from Nada El-Makashfi, one of my favorite Twitter posters in Madison. And she writes, "I'm sorry. It feels like the Democratic establishment is finally catching on to the fact that taking the gloves off and fighting is actually helpful. Let's remember the left, BIPOC, and those marginalized by political parties that did it first and were shamed." And she's not the only one of people that are noting that they have simply gotten tired of Democrats and progressives either being on defense or working so hard to not be confrontational. And it never pays off. I mean, almost never. You can say that Joe Biden was the closest to that with a whole lot of other firebrands who were running in the Democratic primary in 2020. But let's not think that Joe Biden's campaign was all, you know, sweetness and honey as well. He, you know, metaphorically punched Trump in the mouth every single day. And the lesson to be learned there is that, you know, when somebody's doing wrong, call it out. And when you're being pummeled unfairly, fight back. So I really appreciate Nada doing that. Because right away we see coverage of the president's speech in the New York Times pointing out that, you know, this is a shift in their view of Biden. They write, "In several recent speeches, Mr. Biden has replaced his usual calls for unity with sharp condemnations of MAGA extremists, saying Republicans have embraced semi-fascism." And my goodness, again, the feigned, you know, shock that President Biden would use the phrase semi-fascism. How hurtful, how negative, how divisive. Are you kidding me? Are you listening to the things that the invectives that come out from right-wing politicians and the media ecosystem? But I continue from the New York Times. Mr. Biden's combative message coincides with new polling that suggests his party's fortunes and his own popularity have improved after several legislative accomplishments, a decline in gas prices, and strong job growth that has given Democrats hope that they may retain control of Congress. Says Quentin James, president of Collective PAC, an organization dedicated to electing African-American officials, "I think finally the party and the people are waking up to see we have to hold these folks accountable. You may be paying a little more for your groceries, but the reality of what's on the other side is more dire." And that's an interesting point to make, is that yesterday we talked about ranked choice voting. If you have ranked choice voting, you can then weigh every separate candidate as an individual, judge them on their merits, and rank them. And that would be great if it's what existed on your ballot at the time. But come November, the choice is binary. And like it or not, you can vote for a third party, but that person's not going to win. It might make you feel better, but you really have had no say in who wins or who loses. When the choice is binary, you can say it's the lesser of two evils. And again, if that makes you feel better, say it. But it's still a choice. And the choice right now is one that can fairly be accused of embracing semi-fascism, and one that, like they say, is finally waking up and seeing you have to hold these folks accountable. So Nada and others are right to call out the fact that this is overdue, but that at least it is finally happening. In a brand new story posted at upnorthnewswi.com just minutes ago, the headline, "Companies and Executives Sent Jobs Out of Wisconsin and Sent Money to Ron Johnson." Senator Ron Johnson has received $77,400 over the years from people and firms engaged in outsourcing work to other states and countries, according to a review of campaign finance records provided to Up North News. Johnson said earlier this year he would not ask a hometown manufacturer to locate about 1,000 new jobs in Oshkosh, but he also has a history of comments that suggest he supports outsourcing jobs. For example, in September of 2020, he said to the Commercial Association of Realtors Wisconsin, quote, "To me, it makes no sense for American workers to produce high labor content products. Let the billions of people around the world do that and provide us these goods. High quality, dirt cheap." That's how he sees outsourcing of American jobs, as something that's dirt cheap and therefore, of course, good for corporate profits. In 2014, Johnson told the Journal Sentinel that outsourcing had been, quote, "quite beneficial to America." Johnson's pro-outsourcing sentiments have struck a chord with some of his campaign donors, at least according to a review of Federal Elections Commission records of contributions to his campaign and affiliated political action committees. And here are some examples. Executives from Briggs & Stratton have donated nearly $9,000 to Johnson during his career. In 2021, Briggs & Stratton laid off 228 Wisconsin workers because it was cheaper to import a similar product from China. In 2010, Johnson received $3,400 from the president of Northern Engraving, a company that later moved 180 jobs from La Crosse to Mexico, claiming labor was cheaper. Eaton Corporation and its executives donated $4,200 to Johnson, even though between 2014 and 2021, Eaton laid off 425 workers and outsourced the jobs to Mexico and China. Johnson received at least $23,500 from Pitney Bowes, which in 2014 and 15 outsourced jobs from Wisconsin to Panama, the Philippines, and India. Johnson received at least $7,400 from executives of Husco International, a company that had $350,000 in state tax credits revoked in 2016 after it outsourced nearly 100 jobs out of Waukesha. Assurant, which in 2013 offshored 130 jobs from Wisconsin to India, provided at least $5,500 in donations to Johnson. Johnson also received $4,000 from Rock10, a company that in 2013 laid off 125 of its employees and transferred their jobs overseas, and $20,500 from Anthem Insurance Company's WellPoint, a company that in 2012 outsourced Wisconsin jobs overseas. After the remarks that Johnson made in 2020 calling for praising outsourcing, Congressman Mark Pocan, called Johnson stunningly out of touch. And the story concludes with a quote from Congressman Pocan. "It was spoken like a true robber baron would speak. It's pretty amazing that the senator from a state that has been hit so hard by outsourcing, by jobs going to Mexico and overseas, would find the answer to providing families with family supporting wages is to continue to outsource more things overseas." And again, that's a story that just posted at Up North News minutes ago, where I will say again, these are much like the Tim Michaels contributions that were reported on the other day. This is reporting of what happened. This is reporting of what he said. And we have taken note of the other things that have been said. We said earlier in the show, Ron Johnson saying directly, "I'm not trying to cut Social Security or Medicare. I'm trying to save it." Okay, we've reported that. And we've also reported what he has proposed, which would put Social Security and Medicare up for a vote every 5 years, 2 years, maybe 1 year, depending on how it's treated in the budget. These are things that are just being reported, because if you relied only on what we're able to get from Ron Johnson from campaign commercials versus the recordings that are made from events like the one this week and the one last week that are reported on by other great reporters, well, you would have a completely different view of what the senior senator from Wisconsin thinks about economic development. This is a person who, in saying he was not going to push Oshkosh Defense to locate 1,000 jobs in his hometown, he said, "It's not like we don't have enough jobs here already in Wisconsin." Now, that's not going to stop people from supporting him. Again, you see the commercials, either from Johnson or from that PAC started by the billionaires or other outside groups that will say, you know, that Ron Johnson is trying to hold the line against high spending that leads to inflation. But that's not factually accurate. Inflation is a global phenomenon brought about by the economy recovering from, or at least trying to come out of, a pandemic. The spending that they're talking about is spending in pandemic relief that only prevented the depression in the American economy and is making what will be at least a decade-long investment in infrastructure, creating jobs in everything from roads and bridges to broadband to sewer lines. All of these things are going to create jobs. That's what that spending is going to do. It's going to be put back into the pockets of American workers. It's not that Ron Johnson hasn't approved of spending previously. It's just that the spending he approved came in the form of $2 trillion in tax cuts that overwhelmingly went to billionaires, millionaires, and the highest of income brackets. So he is willing to spend taxpayer dollars. It really is just a question of how to spend it and what would be the ultimate impact of that spending. And so over these next couple of months here, while we're just under, let's see, where are we, 67 days until the election. You know, there will be these messages one way or the other. And in stories like what we just reported to you and in commercials that are run, we just want to make sure that we offer the perspective of what has been offered and what is being offered to the voters moving forward. The forecast for this weekend. Yeah, it looks mighty nice after today. As a cold front comes through, it's going to trigger some scattered showers and some scattered thunderstorms. And some of them could be heavy, so be sure you monitor your local forecast. But then once that's done moving through, we have a sunny and dry Saturday, most of Saturday, if not all of it, Sunday and Monday, with temps only in the mid-70s roughly. We'll get back into the mid-80s, just not until after Luke is back from Door County and has been treated for hypothermia or whatever it is. So I'm sorry that this ruined any hopes you had of swimming in the lake.
I'm bringing my swimsuit still, and I know how to pack, so I'm going to have my my sleeping bag. If a nice 50-degree, even high 40-degree evening is wonderful out in the woods, and I'm looking forward to it.
You should, and I will say that I didn't look to see. I don't think there's going to be much of a wind since we're going to be back into a drier pattern. So there are going to be some amazing campfire stories told this weekend. Whether you're camping or, in my case, if it's in your backyard, this could be a great weekend for just enjoying some well-deserved time around the campfire. We all have earned it. Back after this. You're up north.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
So I'm being trolled already before the weekend ends by a producer that wants to insist on putting up the most cliched yacht rock tunes possible, but we'll fight about that later on. First, we've got to get to Michigan politics as we continue our whip around the country today, wrapping up the week with headlines. And so we make a stop in Michigan and the Gander. Found at gandernewsroom.com, the Courier newsroom outlet there, our sister to Up North News, where editor Kyle Kaminsky and reporter Hope Odell join us now. And it's great to have both of you here. Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks.
So we've got a couple of things to get into here, maybe not on the level of the ridiculousness that is Pennsylvania, but you know, we had them last hour, so we'll see if you can give them a run for the money, and then we'll let the listeners decide. And of course, we're certainly trying to do what we can in Wisconsin. We brought up an episode in Minnesota earlier in the show, but in Michigan, there's been a couple of interesting developments, and I'm going to start with something that took place last weekend. Kyle, you were at a nominating convention. Now, we've already had our primary. We have a case where the governor and lieutenant governor don't run as a ticket. They don't run as running mates. So whoever wins, excuse me, the lieutenant governor primary is the running mate for the gubernatorial candidate. So that's kind of our system of nominating things. Tell me about this nominating convention that was held in Michigan last weekend.
Well, it's typically a pretty smooth process where the candidate picks the lieutenant governor, and it's more of a formality where the party has a confirmation. A little bit of tension this time around. I guess you might even describe it as chaos. There was some dissatisfaction with Tudor Dixon, the Republican nominee's pick for lieutenant governor, and actually a faction of delegates that were leading a charge to pick the fifth place contender in the governor's race as the lieutenant governor. So chaos at the convention was a common headline on Saturday, and I thankfully was able to sit out the convention, but I made it to the after party on the Capitol lawn, which I'm pretty sure might have been messier than the convention itself.
Really? What's is the headline? Republicans in disarray?
You know, at a time where the party really needed to unify, I think that there was a major absence of unity from Saturday. I mean, at least at the onset, the cards ended up lining up with the lieutenant governor that Dixon picked on the ticket here. But some disagreements ahead of time.
Well, and we've talked before about Tudor Dixon and how the entire primary was shaken with like half of the contenders being kicked off the ballot because of, you know, fraud on the nominating petitions. So, I mean, Hope, we already knew that Tudor has embraced some, rather extreme, you know, positions or logic or rhetoric. And it seems that she is not backing down on that, even to the point of, you know, young rape victims aren't being seen any more kindly in her eyes than they were before.
Yeah. She has gone back and forth on abortion a little bit, depending on who she talks to. It seems she has gone between saying that she is in favor of exceptions for rape and incest in an abortion ban, and then goes back to saying no exceptions totally. So it seems like she's flip-flopping, but now she's found a much more steadfast opinion in that no exceptions period on an abortion ban in Michigan.
Her latest theory is that a 14-year-old girl would bond with the baby of a rapist, so it's okay.
So it's okay to force a 14-year-old rape victim to go through all of pregnancy, labor, and everything that goes with it. Cool. So was it that at the nominating convention, I mean, as if that weren't extreme enough, were people there saying that her choice of running mate wasn't extreme enough for them and they had to get somebody else, or were they trying to moderate her on the ticket?
The person that they were trying to bring into the fold, the fifth place runner-up in the Republican primary, was Ralph Reban. He's a conservative pastor who actually, I believe, had the most rigid stance against abortion. He was one of the more extreme candidates in that field, and that was the strongest push on the convention to put him in the place, even above the lieutenant governor who was picked, who was declared the most conservative lawmaker during his tenure in the legislature. So, yeah.
So we really have, a case where extreme abortion politics kind of is ruling the roost in some of these state parties. Now, I wonder if there are exceptions to the rule amongst Michigan Republicans, because in Wisconsin, it's a very small number still. I mean, it's not like there's a Liz Cheney, on every street corner here, but there are one or two Republicans that have been somewhat vocal that, we're going to lose our party, our party's going to lose its way, et cetera, et cetera. Again, tiny minority, but at least there's something there. Is there an identifiable segment of that hope as well amongst Michigan Republicans or not?
I would say that there are certainly Republicans in the legislature specifically who most likely think that, but there's no one coming out really in saying it. But I did a story a couple weeks ago about bipartisanship in the Michigan legislature and talked to a Republican strategist who was a communications person for Governor John Engler. And he said that, behind closed doors, Republicans are working with Democrats to get things done in Michigan still, but no one's really coming out to be that Liz Cheney for Michigan.
Kyle, do you see any signs of that anyplace?
It's really disappointing when you look at the top of the ticket. I mean, I'm sure those voices are out there, but they're certainly not dominating the voices. We have a governor, a lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general nominee, all who believe there were fraud in the 2020 election. No proof of that. They all support no allowances for abortion. Republicans in Michigan, I guess, have a knack for creating boogeymen out of problems that don't really exist. I mean, at the Capitol lawn after the convention, I heard a ton of talk about how we need to ban CRT from schools, critical race theory. We need to ban drag queens from schools. We need to reopen Michigan businesses. We need to get kids back in classrooms. All of these things are happening. I mean, businesses are open, kids are back in class, there aren't drag queens in public schools, there's not a single district that teaches critical race theory. So it's just a lot of fear-mongering on extreme viewpoints that really aren't affecting everyday Michiganders.
We are joined by Kyle Kaminsky, editor, Hope Odell, reporter from The Gander out in Michigan. This next topic is also abortion-based, but it really is, it talks about the infrastructure of state politics. Because here in Wisconsin, we have a Wisconsin Elections Commission that was created by Republicans when they controlled the legislature to have gridlock. They created it with three Republicans, three Democrats. They threw out the Government Accountability Board, which had worked so well for years, made up of retired impartial judges, and replaced it with this thing destined for gridlock. Now in Michigan, I'm seeing that unlike Wisconsin, which does not have ballot initiatives, Michigan does have ballot initiatives. And that, if I'm reading this right, Hope, this is a proposal for a ballot initiative that seemed to be on the up and up, but faced its own death by deadlock.
Yeah. So basically, there's been an initiative to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would guarantee abortion access for everyone in Michigan. And the Bureau of Elections verified that it had enough valid signatures to get on the ballot. And on Wednesday, the Board of Canvassers met, and they usually just do clerical things like approve the language. But this time, with there are two Republicans and two Democrats on the board, the two Republicans voted against putting the amendment on the ballot. And when there's a deadlock, that means it's rejected. So as of right now, it's not going to be on the ballot, but the group behind it is expected to appeal to the Supreme Court, which does tend to lean Democratic. And some sources I've talked to who helped write the amendment said that they expect the Supreme Court to let it get on the ballot.
Kyle, is there, I mean, was a any kind of valid reason given to, at least, did they at least try to put some kind of a nonpartisan veneer on their decision?
The biggest sticking point was a lack of spaces in some of the language. And we're talking real minor typographical fixes. You could understand it was clearly worded. I mean, experts have gone over this. It's been decided that it's very clear language. It was just minor typographical errors that derailed the process. And the thing that shocks me about this is, I mean, this wasn't supposed to happen. This is an administrative board that really isn't supposed to weed into the politics. And they're supposed to make sure the language is clear, make sure the signatures are valid, and give voters a say. And right now it's being blocked from that process. I think there is some light at the end of the tunnel with some hope at the Supreme Court next week. But yeah, this kind of extreme politics has bled down even into simple administrative election boards.
But to even get there, as noted in an AP story over at gandernewsroom.com, you know, election law in Michigan doesn't have requirements about spacing, and the people opposed to the petition, quote, are unable to point to a single individual that did not understand the petition. So it's not as if the petition wasn't clear. I mean, we're really talking technicalities to the nth degree here. Now, there's somebody we haven't talked about that seems to be a theme in the program today. We've talked earlier about how pretty much so many of our shows today and in the past have included mentions of Ron Johnson rather than Mandela Barnes, because Ron Johnson is sane and doing, you know, outrageous things. And in Pennsylvania, we're hearing all about Doug Mastriano, the Republican candidate for governor, and very little about Josh Shapiro, but that's because Mastriano is doing all kinds of things. We've mentioned Tudor Dixon quite a bit. We haven't heard the name Gretchen Whitmer yet. So are we seeing the same situation where, again, we started with Tudor Dixon because of positions and claims and quotes, but again, in all three of these cases, it's not like Barnes and Shapiro and Whitmer are in hiding, but they're certainly not making Kyle the headlines, you know, that their Republican opponents are.
They're working behind the scenes. I mean, Whitmer, I get a press release from Whitmer's office probably every other day about some State Department being directed to expand options for reproductive health. Court battle is constantly being waged here. I mean, Whitmer's right at the forefront of trying to get the Supreme Court to weigh in once and for all on reproductive rights in Michigan. So I think a lot of what you're seeing isn't empty rhetoric on the stage at the Capitol and misleading claims. It's actual work that's being done to try to protect rights here. And sadly, that's not the flashiest stuff to get attention when you're not screaming on the Capitol lawn.
I guess not. It's tough for policy to get a leg up. Hope, are there other races, down ballot races or congressional races that are getting a special focus as well, besides the ones that we happen to notice from beyond the borders?
I would say that in terms of abortion access specifically, probably the biggest race right now is still the attorney general's, because depending on who wins, they have the authority to potentially enforce a statewide abortion ban that, as of right now, Nestle is choosing not to enforce. So that's probably the biggest race in terms of abortion access, I would say.
Now, that's interesting that, yes, there's an abortion ban on the books in Michigan. The one in Wisconsin dates from 1849, and it immediately went back into effect, even, you know, with Democratic Governor Tony Evers. Democratic Attorney General Josh Call has taken it to court, but for now, that ban is in place. You're saying it works the other way in Michigan, where the ban is not being enforced, so it's not truly in place, at least at this point.
Yeah, that's because before the Roe decision, Governor Whitmer had already started a lawsuit, attempting to put a pause on that ban. And then another one by, I believe, Planned Parenthood is also in the works. So two lawsuits are currently keeping that ban on pause, hopefully until, you know, that amendment gets on the ballot and gets passed.
All right. So you guys are following a Supreme Court consideration on the referendum question, along with so many other races. And in all of these states, you can hear state legislative candidates going, what's a guy got to do to get a break here to get some coverage? But there's just there is just such a fire hose of news in these marquee races. Kyle Kaminsky, Hope Odell, thank you so much for the visit and for the update. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.
All right. We will be back to wrap up the show after this. You're up north. I am still trying to, of all the things we talked about on the program today, I'm still trying to come to terms with the note that there were, in all the material taken from Mar-a-Lago that Donald Trump stole away from the White House, 43 empty folders, 43 empty folders that were marked classified. Classified on the folder, nothing inside. It doesn't mean that the documents aren't there. It doesn't mean the documents were there to begin with, that he scooped up a bunch of empty folders, you know, in the White House. But probably not. Because again, it gets you to the caretaking of each individual document. What it says is that, and let's just for the sake of argument say it was one document in each folder rather than 10 pages or whatever. So that we're talking about 43 folders, we're talking about 43 documents. What it tells you is that because it's been reported that in a lot of cases, Trump would get these in a meeting and then he'd say, can I take this? And some poor staffer would be like, well, you're the president, I guess. And he would take it up to the residence and then nothing more would come of it. And then he packs it away. The caretaking that's supposed to go into that document, it comes out of the document, you look at it, you put it back in there. So it could be argued that, you know, those documents still exist and that they're just somewhere else. They just weren't put back in the folder. Guys, this isn't a case of pulling a photograph out of one of the old albums and then, you know, conveniently forgetting to put it back in the album and it ends up in a box. I mean, it's still a dumb thing to do, and you're going to hate yourself later when you go looking for that photo, but that's not the same as mishandling a classified document. And that's only if we're giving Trump and other people in his orbit the benefit of the doubt that they've just been mishandled and that they might be floating someplace else. The odds that the president of the United States just took an empty folder with him can't be good. Again, what's he going to do? Try to impress somebody? He's got plenty of other ways that he tries to do that. So an empty folder mark classified isn't going to do it. And as you know, was it you or Mark Jacob that said, you know, in this day and age, you could leave the document there, just take a picture of it if that, need be.
That was Mark. Mark was saying, like, if he wanted to just be able to sell state secrets, and I think it was during a commercial break, he essentially was like, yeah, Trump could have took the photos of whatever he wanted at that time, and it would have been just, he would have gotten away with it. Nobody would have ever known, because you wouldn't find out until after, like, it'd be very difficult to track that. You'd have to get the cell phone data and stuff. But leaving with these folders and documents is, what irks me the most, I think, about all of this is his entire campaign was around Hillary's emails. His, yes. A large premise of the reason he ran for president was because he saw an opening where he could hit a candidate over and over and over again for mishandling classified information. And he's going to bookend that with how he started his candidacy, I think, with what will ultimately be his downfall. Because, like you said, with the Nixon tapes, like 18 minutes.
It's the 18 and a half minute gap. Yeah. Yes. No.
43 empty top secret folders. And I don't... Sean Duffy trying to give him room, trying to give him some breathing room, saying, well, the only way that this would be bad and the only way the Department of Justice would be able to hold him criminally liable is if there were top secret documents in his desk drawer. Well, folks, That's what it was. And we don't even know where 43 of these documents are because they're not in the folders that they were supposed to be in.
And so now we are left to speculate only because, again, we, much like the investigators, you have to ask yourself what could have been done with them. And again, it is completely possible that he used the back of them to test out numbers for Sudoku or letters for a crossword puzzle, something like that.
No.
The odds are a little better that he was showing it to somebody and said, oh yeah, here, you know, here, take this, you know, again, to look impressive. And that in his mind, this really shouldn't have been classified. It's really not that secret here. And that, you know, he's basically giving people souvenirs is a reasonable thing to consider. And then of course there's the things that are darker and that you don't even want to think could conceivably be possible in terms of not just whether he gave a document to somebody with hostile intentions toward the United States, but even if he just showed it, and or even if they were stolen without, you know, with somebody else in the office. Remember, it was one of his attorneys who said on Fox News on Wednesday the most unbelievable thing when she was trying to defend the documents being in his office and saying, oh, they're always stored properly in the office. There have been many visitors in there, and you know, they've never been spilled on the floor like that. And again, there have been many visitors in this room with documents marked classified, with documents marked top secret, with documents marked confidential. There were people in there. The narcissism was already off the charts to begin with. Now to get it to a point where it actually endangers national security is breathtaking. And the only thing that comes close to matching it is the attempts to defend this or to make excuses for it. And let's be clear. These documents and the national security implications are not things that affect the average voter. And that's what Republicans are telling people. These things don't matter when people are paying a high price for gas. And these things don't matter when people are, you know, sending their kids to school. And they're right. Because again, when government works best, they don't have to think about those things. When we have to think about whether a president of the United States has been careless or criminal with national secrets, when families actually have to think about those things, then we got a problem. And that's where we're at right now. So as much as certain Trump supporters and defenders are going to try to say this is not something on the minds of families, it's on the minds of more than what there should be. And it's going to be on the minds of more, I fear, as we continue to learn more about this. All right. Well, come Monday, we will not be here. We will either be there's a chance there's a rerun, but more likely, Luke, the coverage will have already begun at Laborfest in Milwaukee.
No, I believe the Laborfest parade ends at noon. So the plan there is going to be noon to 3 live coverage from the Laborfest grounds. President Joe Biden going to be in town. Mike Crute, Earl Ingram are going to be on the scene. So best of show for these fine airwaves on Bull Falls Radio.
Well, won't that be a challenge to figure out if there is, in fact, enough material for a best of show? I mean, we've got 25 in the books, so, you know, you be the judge. Have a great holiday weekend, everybody. We'll see you Tuesday.